From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today is special, a tale of two treaties.
This limited test ban, in our most careful judgment, is safer by far for the United States than an unlimited nuclear arms race.
Echoes of President John F. Kennedy filled the halls of American University Wednesday as President Barack Obama, like his predecessor a half century before, explained to the world why the nuclear arms agreement he negotiated was the best of a limited set of available options. It was on August 5, 1963, that the United States and the Soviet Union signed the so-called Limited Test Ban Treaty, which outlawed nuclear testing in the atmosphere, underwater, and in outer space. Kennedy had first revealed to a surprised world that his administration was negotiating the deal with Moscow during a speech at American University in June of 1963. A month later, on July 26th, he was on national television selling the treaty to the American public.
I am hopeful that this nation will promptly approve the Limited Test Ban Treaty. There will, of course, be debate in the country and in the Senate. The Constitution wisely requires the advice and consent of the Senate to all treaties, and that consultation has already begun. All this is as it should be, a document which may mark an historic and constructive opportunity for the world deserves an historic and constructive debate. It is my hope that all of you will take part in that debate, for this treaty is for all of us. It is particularly for our children and our grandchildren, and they have no lobby here in Washington. This debate will involve military, scientific, and political experts, but it must be not left to them alone. The right and the responsibility are yours. If we are to open new doorways to peace, if we are to seize this rare opportunity for progress, if we are to be as bold and far-sighted in our control of weapons as we have been in their invention, then let us now show all the world that a strong America also stands for peace. Let history record that we, in this land, at this time, took the first step.
The Nuclear Test Ban Treaty sailed through the U.S. Senate in September of 1963 on an 80-19 vote. It was signed by President Kennedy on October 7, 1963, about a month and a half before his assassination. President Obama's choice of venue Wednesday was clearly intended to invoke the imagery of Kennedy's precedent, as his opening remarks made clear.
52 years ago, President Kennedy, at the height of the Cold War, addressed this same university on the subject of peace. The Berlin Wall had just been built. The Soviet Union had tested the most powerful weapons ever developed. China was on the verge of acquiring a nuclear bomb. Less than 20 years after the end of World War II, the prospect of nuclear war was all too real. With all of the threats that we face today, it's hard to appreciate how much more dangerous the world was at that time.
After drawing that picture of the relative risks of Kennedy's treaty with the Soviet Union, a mere 9 months after the Cuban Missile Crisis, and with verification limited to the technology of the 1960s, as measured against the much lower risks to the U.S. of Iranian noncompliance, President Obama laid out his argument for congressional and public support for the deal.
Today I want to speak to you about this deal and the most consequential foreign policy debate that our country has had since the invasion of Iraq. As Congress decides whether to support this historic diplomatic breakthrough or instead blocks it over the objection of the vast majority of the world. Between now and the congressional vote in September. You are going to hear a lot of arguments against this deal, backed by tens of millions of dollars in advertising. And if the rhetoric in these ads and the accompanying commentary sounds familiar, it should. For many of the same people who argued for the war in Iraq are now making the case against the Iran nuclear deal. Now, when I ran for president 8 years ago as a candidate who had opposed the decision to go to war in Iraq, I said that America didn't just have to end that war. We had to end the mindset that got us there in the first place. It was a mindset characterized by a preference for military action over diplomacy. A mindset that put a premium on unilateral U.S. action over the painstaking work of building international consensus. A mindset that exaggerated threats beyond what the intelligence supported. Leaders did not level with the American people about the costs of war, insisting that we could easily impose our will on a part of the world with a profoundly different culture and history. And of course, those calling for war labeled themselves strong and decisive, while dismissing those who disagreed as weak, even appeasers of a malevolent adversary. More than a decade later, we still live with the consequences of the decision to invade Iraq. Our troops achieved every mission they were given, but thousands of lives were lost, tens of thousands wounded. That doesn't count the lives lost among Iraqis. Nearly $1 trillion was spent. Today, Iraq remains gripped by sectarian conflict, and the emergence of Al-Qaeda in Iraq has now evolved into ISIL. And ironically, the single greatest beneficiary in the region of that war was the Islamic Republic of Iran, which saw its strategic position strengthened by the removal of its long-standing enemy, Saddam Hussein. I raise this recent history because now more than ever, we need clear thinking in our foreign policy. And I raise this history because it bears directly on how we respond to the Iranian nuclear program. That program has been around for decades, dating back to the Shah's efforts, with U.S. support, in the 1960s and 70s to develop nuclear power. The theocracy that overthrew the Shah accelerated the program after the Iran-Iraq War in the 1980s, a war in which Saddam Hussein used chemical weapons to brutal effect. And Iran's nuclear program advanced steadily through the 1990s, despite unilateral U.S. sanctions. When the Bush administration took office, Iran had no centrifuges, the machines necessary to produce material for a bomb that were spinning to enrich uranium. But despite repeated warnings from the United States government, by the time I took office, Iran had installed several thousand centrifuges and showed no inclination to slow, much less halt, its program. Among U.S. policymakers, there's never been disagreement on the danger posed by an Iranian nuclear bomb. Democrats and Republicans alike have recognized that it would spark an arms race in the world's most unstable region and turn every crisis into a potential nuclear showdown. It would embolden terrorist groups like Hezbollah and pose an unacceptable risk to Israel, which Iranian leaders have repeatedly threatened to destroy. More broadly, it could unravel the global commitment to nonproliferation that the world has done so much to defend. The question, then, is not whether to prevent Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon, but how. Even before taking office, I made clear that Iran would not be allowed to acquire a nuclear weapon on my watch. And it's been my policy throughout my presidency to keep all options, including possible military options, on the table to achieve that objective. But I have also made clear my preference for a peaceful diplomatic resolution of the issue. Not just because of the costs of war, but also because a negotiated agreement offered a more effective, verifiable, and durable resolution. And so in 2009, we let the Iranians know that a diplomatic path was available. Iran failed to take that path, and our intelligence community exposed the existence of a covert nuclear facility at Fordow. Now, some have argued that Iran's intransigence showed the futility of negotiations. In fact, it was our very willingness to negotiate that helped America rally the world to our cause and secured international participation in an unprecedented framework of commercial and financial sanctions. Keep in mind, unilateral U.S. sanctions against Iran had been in place for decades, but had failed to pressure Iran to the negotiating table. What made our new approach more effective was our ability to draw upon new U.N. Security Council resolutions, combining strong enforcement with voluntary agreements from nations like China and India, Japan and South Korea to reduce their purchases of Iranian oil, as well as the imposition by our European allies of a total oil embargo. Winning this global buy-in was not easy. I know. I was there. In some cases, our partners lost billions of dollars in trade because of their decision to cooperate. But we were able to convince them that, absent a diplomatic resolution, the result could be war, with major disruptions to the global economy and even greater instability in the Middle East. In other words, it was diplomacy, hard, painstaking diplomacy, not saber-rattling, not tough talk, that ratcheted up the pressure on Iran. With the world now unified beside us, Iran's economy contracted severely and remains about 20% smaller today than it would have otherwise been. No doubt this hardship played a role in Iran's 2013 elections, when the Iranian people elected a new government that promised to improve the economy through engagement with the world. A window had cracked open. Iran came back to the nuclear talks. And after a series of negotiations, Iran agreed with the international community to an interim deal, a deal that rolled back Iran's stockpile of near 20% enriched uranium and froze the progress of its program so that the P5 plus one, the United States, China, Russia, the United Kingdom, Germany, France, and the European Union, could negotiate a comprehensive deal without the fear that Iran might be stalling for time. Now, let me pause here just to remind everybody that when the interim deal was announced, critics, the same critics we're hearing from now, called it a historic mistake. They insisted Iran would ignore its obligations. They warned that sanctions would unravel. They warned that Iran would receive a windfall to support terrorism. The critics were wrong. The progress of Iran's nuclear program was halted for the first time in a decade. Its stockpile of dangerous materials was reduced. The deployment of its advanced centrifuges was stopped. Inspections did increase. There was no flood of money into Iran. and the architecture of the international sanctions remained in place. In fact, the interim deal worked so well that the same people who criticized it so fiercely now cite it as an excuse not to support the broader accord. Think about that. What was once proclaimed as a historic mistake is now held up as a success and a reason to not sign the comprehensive deal. So keep that in mind when you assess the credibility of the arguments being made against diplomacy today. Despite the criticism, we moved ahead to negotiate a more lasting, comprehensive deal. Our diplomats, led by Secretary of State John Kerry, kept our coalition united. Our nuclear experts, including one of the best in the world, Secretary of Energy Ernie Moniz, worked tirelessly on the technical details. In July, we reached a comprehensive plan of action that meets our objectives. Under its terms, Iran is never allowed to build a nuclear weapon. And while Iran, like any party to the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, is allowed to access peaceful nuclear energy, the agreement strictly defines the manner in which its nuclear program can proceed, ensuring that all pathways to a bomb are cut off. Here's how. Under this deal, Iran cannot acquire the plutonium needed for a bomb. The core of its heavy water reactor at Iraq will be pulled out, filled with concrete, and replaced with one that will not produce plutonium for a weapon. The spent fuel from that reactor will be shipped out of the country, and Iran will not build any new heavy water reactors for at least 15 years. Iran will also not be able to acquire the enriched uranium that could be used for a bomb. As soon as this deal is implemented, Iran will remove 2/3 of its centrifuges. For the next decade, Iran will not enrich uranium with its more advanced centrifuges. Iran will not enrich uranium at the previously undisclosed Fordow facility, which is buried deep underground, for at least 15 years. Iran will get rid of 98% of its stockpile of enriched uranium, which is currently enough for up to 10 nuclear bombs, for the next 15 years. Even after those 15 years have passed, Iran will never have the right to use a peaceful program as cover to pursue a weapon. And in fact, this deal shuts off the type of covert path Iran pursued in the past. There will be 24/7 monitoring of Iran's key nuclear facilities. For decades, inspectors will have access to Iran's entire nuclear supply chain, from the uranium mines and mills where they get raw materials to the centrifuge production facilities where they make machines to enrich it. And understand why this is so important. For Iran to cheat, it has to build a lot more than just one building or covert facility like Fordow. It would need a secret source for every single aspect of its program. No nation in history has been able to pull off such subterfuge when subjected to such rigorous inspections. And under the terms of the deal, inspectors will have the permanent ability to inspect any suspicious sites in Iran. And finally, Iran has powerful incentives to keep its commitments. Before getting sanctions relief, Iran has to take significant concrete steps, like removing centrifuges and getting rid of its stockpile. If Iran violates the agreement over the next decade, all of the sanctions can snap back into place. We won't need the support of other members of the UN Security Council. America can trigger snapback on our own. On the other hand, if Iran abides by the deal, and its economy begins to reintegrate with the world, the incentive to avoid snapback will only grow. So this deal is not just the best choice among alternatives. This is the strongest non-proliferation agreement ever negotiated. And because this is such a strong deal, every nation in the world that has commented publicly with the exception of the Israeli government, has expressed support. The United Nations Security Council has unanimously supported it. The majority of arms control and non-proliferation experts support it. Over 100 former ambassadors who served under Republican and Democratic presidents support it. I've had to make a lot of tough calls as president. But whether or not this deal is good for American security is not one of those calls. It's not even close. Unfortunately, we're living through a time in American politics where every foreign policy decision is viewed through a partisan prism, evaluated by headline-grabbing soundbites. And so, before the ink was even dry on this deal, before Congress even read it, a majority of Republicans declared their virulent opposition. Lobbyists and pundits were suddenly transformed into armchair nuclear scientists, disputing the assessments of experts like Secretary Moniz, challenging his findings, offering multiple and sometimes contradictory arguments about why Congress should reject this deal. But if you repeat these arguments long enough, they can get some traction. So let me address just a few of the arguments that have been made so far in opposition to this deal. First, there are those who say the inspections are not strong enough because inspectors can't go anywhere in Iran at any time with no notice. Well, here's the truth. Inspectors will be allowed daily access to Iran's key nuclear sites. If there's a reason for inspecting a suspicious, undeclared site anywhere in Iran, inspectors will get that access even if Iran objects. This access can be with as little as 24 hours' notice. And while the process for resolving a dispute about access can take up to 24 days, once we've identified a site that raises suspicion, we will be watching it continuously until inspectors get in. And by the way, nuclear material isn't something you hide in the closet. It can leave a trace for years. The bottom line is, if Iran cheats, we can catch them, and we will. Second, there are those who argue that the deal isn't strong enough because some of the limitations on Iran's civilian nuclear program expire in 15 years. Let me repeat. The prohibition on Iran having a nuclear weapon is permanent. The ban on weapons-related research is permanent. Inspections are permanent. It is true that some of the limitations regarding Iran's peaceful program last only 15 years. But that's how arms control agreements work. The first SALT treaty with the Soviet Union lasted 5 years. The first START treaty lasted 15 years. And in our current situation, if 15 or 20 years from now Iran tries to build a bomb, this deal ensures that the United States will have better tools to detect it, a stronger basis under international law to respond, and the same options available to stop a weapons program as we have today, including, if necessary, military options. On the other hand, without this deal, the scenarios that critics warn about happening in 15 years could happen 6 months from now. By killing this deal, Congress would not merely pave Iran's pathway to a bomb, it would accelerate it. Third, a number of critics say the deal isn't worth it because Iran will get billions of dollars in sanctions relief. Now, let's be clear. The international sanctions were put in place precisely to get Iran to agree to constraints on its program. That's the point of sanctions. any negotiated agreement with Iran would involve sanctions relief. So an argument against sanctions relief is effectively an argument against any diplomatic resolution of this issue. It is true that if Iran lives up to its commitments, it will gain access to roughly $56 billion of its own money, revenue frozen overseas by other countries. But the notion that this will be a game changer, with all this money funneled into Iran's pernicious activities, misses the reality of Iran's current situation. Partly because of our sanctions, the Iranian government has over half a trillion dollars in urgent requirements, from funding pensions and salaries to paying for crumbling infrastructure. Iran's leaders have raised the expectations of their people that sanctions relief will improve their lives. Even a repressive regime like Iran's cannot completely ignore those expectations. And that's why our best analysts expect the bulk of this revenue to go into spending that improves the economy and benefits the lives of the Iranian people. Now, this is not to say that sanctions relief will provide no benefit to Iran's military. Let's stipulate that some of that money will flow to activities that we object to. We have no illusions about the Iranian government or the significance of the Revolutionary Guard and the Quds Force. Iran supports terrorist organizations like Hezbollah. It supports proxy groups that threaten our interests and the interests of our allies. But Iran has been engaged in these activities for decades. They engaged in them before sanctions and while sanctions were in place. In fact, Iran even engaged in these activities in the middle of the Iran-Iraq War, a war that cost them nearly a million lives and hundreds of billions of dollars. The truth is that Iran has always found a way to fund these efforts. And whatever benefit Iran may claim from sanctions relief pales in comparison to the danger it could pose with a nuclear weapon.
The president will have a hard time selling this to many in the United States, as Caleb Maupin from the International Action Center explains.
There are some forces in the United States that are very, very committed to hostility with Iran. First, you have the military contractors, and then the corporations contracted by the Pentagon. That includes General Electric, Raytheon, Boeing. These corporations make lots of money from war and militarism. And next, you have the oil cartels, the oil corporations, which themselves see Iran as a competitor. Iranian oil on the international market makes the value of the oil they export go down. And Iran, with its nationalized oil resources, is very much a rival of theirs on the market, as is Russia and Venezuela. And in addition to that, you have the Israel lobby and the Zionists, who do see Iran as a source of opposition to Israel, because since 1979, Iran has been loudly championing the cause of the Palestinian people. So these three forces have kind of joined together and really kind of hijacked U.S. foreign policy when it comes to the Middle East. And they coordinate their activities, they work together, and they're very much doing all they can to play the United States and make tension between the United States and Iran, which is absolutely not necessary. Iran is not a threat to the United States. Iran is not seeking to develop nuclear weapons in any conceivable way. I've been to Iran twice. I was there for over a month last time, and people of Iran want peace. They want peace with the United States. They don't want a confrontation. They don't want a war.
In his closing remarks, President Obama spoke directly to the question of whether he was betraying the interests of Israel by ignoring the vociferous objections of its Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, to the agreement.
As President of the United States, it would be an obligation of my constitutional duty to act against my best judgment simply because it causes temporary friction with a dear friend and ally. I do not believe that would be the right thing to do for the United States. I do not believe it would be the right thing to do for Israel.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.